Okay, I thank the organizers. I'm very happy to speak. I think so. Yeah. Well, this is this is a work done with people in Bariloche with Diego Mazzitelli and Eduardo Testé. It's a paper of the last year, and I will also talk about some new results in collaboration with Eduardo Testé and Gonzalo Torroba that are not yet published. this is a brief plan of my talk. I will start introducing what I will call area terms in entanglement entropy and its possible relation to black hole entropy. Then I will do some easy calculation using mutual information to show that these terms are really universal, can have a universal definition. And then I will pass to describe Adler's E formula for the normalization of the Newton constant and try to make a relation between this formula and the possible and the area terms in entanglement entropy. I will show a derivation of this formula in pure quantum field theory derivation. And I will discuss briefly relations of these area terms with the C theorems in two and three dimensions. I will also discuss some subtleties of this formula for free fields, for free scalars. And then I will show how to check this formula for some with using some results that are already present in the literature for the Ising model and some holographic results. Then I will pass to show how this formula can be checked in complete generality in a holographic calculation. And at the end, I will discuss differences with the normalization of the Newton constant for a simple case of a scalar field. So let us start from the beginning. the relation of entropy and area comes from the black hole entropy. And it was this paper that introduced the idea that perhaps an explanation of black hole entropy was entanglement entropy across the horizon. The idea was that the horizon divides the space in two, and then you trace over the inside part, and you get some entropy for the outside part. We used to say that this tracing splits virtual vacuum fluctuations in two, but we can say in more modern way that there are real EPR pairs in the vacuum that are split in two by the horizon, and then you get some entropy for the outside part. And as the theory is local, there are much more EPR pairs at short distances, so the entropy that is built up is mainly area along the surface. There is also some contribution of long distance, but it's subleading. well, this idea was revived by Zernike in 93 with an actual calculation in quantum field theory, showing that you indeed get area term for the entanglement entropy. And there were around 95 several works doing these analytical calculations of this area law for the entanglement entropy. But the subject faded away in the last part of the 90s because it was clear that one could not regain the value of the Newton constant from this quantum field theory in flat space calculations, and also that this area term in the quantum field theory is not universal. It depends on the regularization one uses to describe it. So the focus after 2000 was mainly on subleading terms, terms that do not depend on the area but depend on other on the full shape of the surface that in principle, you can have an expansion like this. And at the end, with some power, you get some terms that do not depend anymore on the cutoff, and these are universal, and then it has a universal information of the quantum field theory. But as was pointed out by Herbert and Wilczek in 2011, maybe some people before also talk about this, that the area term, if you have masses, you have some scales in your theory, and you look at only at the area term, the term that grows with the area of the region, you still have this is the leading term that diverges with the inverse power of the cutoff to the power d minus 2. And you can replace power of the cutoff by power of the masses. And at the end, you will get some term that is finite, or you can get some logarithmic term. If you have a logarithmic term, this term is universal. And if you don't have a logarithmic term, the constant term is universal. So it doesn't depend on the cutoff. So, there is a way to think about this area term. If you think, for example, you have a sphere and you have a very small sphere, then it doesn't notice about the masses of the theory. But as you increase the size of the sphere, you are going to feel of correlations that fills the masses around the boundary. So the area term is normalized from small sizes to large sizes, and the full normalization of this area term tell you something about the content of masses of the theory. So this idea can be also thought for a black hole. Suppose because somehow you are tracing out fields with masses, and then the Newton constant will also be renormalized. And so the question is whether the universal part, at least, of the area term can be matched with the universal part of the normalization of the Newton constant by tracing out some massive fields. Another question is how to compute, because this part of the entanglement entropy is the simplest one, in the sense of it can also be computed for half a space without caring about the details of the region. So it's the simplest one. And then maybe one can compute it in terms of the operators, the theory, in a close way.
There's a conceptual difference between where these two terms come from. Right? I mean, even though they're both proportional to the scalar, one is pure ultraviolet physics, the other is infrared. So the k zero term proportional to log and cares about the infrared of the.
Yeah, it cares. So if you have a logarithmic term, it will always be determined by how the theory goes to the ultraviolet, because it's still divergent. But in cases you don't have that, the constant term will depend on the full running of the theory from, let's say, ultraviolet to infrared. But if you're looking for a very large region, for example, half a space, you are always sensing on the full running, the whole thing, right? So if your sphere is large enough, you can always think as all this contribution is very high energy around this boundary. In fact, the full story is more complicated than this, and I will talk about this, that you can have different, for other theories, that this is what you get for free theories, but you can have different powers here.
So these k's are dimensionless, right?
Yeah, these k's here are dimensionless numbers.
So, I mean, if I have a theory with various masses,
yeah.
What do I put for m?
Yeah, any scale, and you just change the value of k, right?
So these k's are not really, I mean, they're only defined once you.
Well, yeah, of course, once you have this m, for example, is the gap of the theory, then everything is well defined in a sense, right? But of course, you have to choose one scale to name what is m
yeah.
in the theory, right?
That's really the thing. Okay.
But presumably it's the smallest one within the
library. No, you can choose any scale, even arbitrary scale, but that will change the value of C.
So somehow the well-defined thing, maybe the way to think of it is for a fixed theory, you vary epsilon, and then the well-defined thing is this k naught prime m to the d minus
right.
2, which is dimensionful.
Yeah,
and that's really
yeah.
Well-defined.
In general, it's dimensionful, except in two dimensions. In general, is dimensionful. So
it's that combination.
I will talk mainly about this mu here, the thing that multiplies the area, and this is a dimensionful quantity. This is the thing that is important. Of course, it has some divergent pieces that are non-universal. Unless you define it in a universal way, I will talk about that. For example, one thing that you can wonder is, really, there is some well-defined thing here because it's summed with something that depends on the cutoff. So one thing to think about it is using mutual information of, let's say, two very large half spaces separated by small distance. So this is like kind of universal regularization of the entropy. So we take this limit, and you regain, in this way, all the divergent pieces of the entropy, but now all the coefficients are universal. And you can do the calculation for free fields very easily, because in this case, free fields can be decomposed. You can do Fourier transformation along the parallel directions to the wall. And then the problem is reduced to a tower of masses, of massive three fields in 1 + 1 dimension, this dimension and time. So this is the Hamiltonian. And then we know almost everything about the three fields in 1 + 1 dimension, and the entropy can be parameterized by this function that is, this is a function. And we know the shape of this function. And so the result for the mutual information in this case is different for even dimension and odd dimensions, and you have a sort of different powers of the masses divided by this now physical distance epsilon, and the coefficients can be computed, and all the coefficients depends on these integrals of powers times the C function that are in general complicated numbers, but the logarithmic term in even dimensions comes with this C zero, so the value of C at the origin, and the same happens for all dimensions where the constant term is also proportional to C zero. And C zero is just the Virasoro central charge divided by 3 for the massless case, and it's 1/3 both for fermions and scalars. So these terms are just some rational numbers there, multiplying the masses and the logarithm of the mass. And there is an issue that for a scalar field, you also get an additional term that is not here, that is a log-log term.
Excuse me?
Yeah.
On your previous slide, when you have, there's presumably entangled pairs across the event horizon, which are from vacuum fluctuations. Do you know which bipartite entangled pair that is? Are they triplets or one of the singlets or what?
Well, in general, this is just a cartoon picture. In general, it would be some more complicated thing. But just to think about how much entanglement you get for your distances and large distances, you can think about this. But of course, there is tripartite entanglement. So this is not full the story.
The conventional thing is you have bipartite entanglement and the higher order stuff is some kind of correction term. I'm just talking just on the very simple two-party entanglement.
Yeah.
If you don't know which of the different types of two-party entanglement, whether it's a singlet or one of the three triplets, and you have to randomize, that's not an entangled state. So your theory, I think, needs to specify what entanglement types you have. Right, there's four different versions of a maximally entangled two-qubit state. If you have a uniform superposition of them, right, incoherent mixture, that's not an entangled state acceptable.
This is just a cartoon picture. I'm thinking here about maximal entangled EPR pairs,
right.
But it's just why
there are four different possibilities
of
maximally entangled EPR pairs.
But all give 1/2 log 2, right? Or...
Yeah, but if you take a mixture, I mean, I can show you this in the board after.
No, of course, yeah,
you
but
take a mixture of
no, this
separable state. Right? Your theory
okay.
does need to specify which one it is.
But this is just a
postponed discussion.
Yeah, this is just a. This is just a. This is not the actual story, right? This this is just a picture. Then when summarizing the result for a free field, you get this number. For the scalar, for any dimensions, and just expanding in the dimension here, you get the logarithmic term. For even dimensions, and for all dimensions, you get a constant term. And for the fermion, you get always that is proportional to 1/2 the scalar in any dimension times the dimension of the spinor space. So, and this result, coming from mutual information, also concise with the Herbert-Wilczek result doing the usual heat kernel expansion and the replica trick. So you can see that these numbers are universal. So, well, let's come back to Adler's, to the Newton constant randomization. And there is a nice formula that gives how the Newton constant randomizes once you integrate over some fields. I have to say that this issue there of this subject of relation between the randomization and entanglement entropy and the Newton constant, that there are several papers on this subject, but somehow curiously, none of these papers mention the Adler's formula. Perhaps because the Adler's formula is from the 82, and then they were not thinking about entanglement entropy at all. And also perhaps because Birrer and Davis' book on quantum field theory in pure space is of the same year and doesn't mention the Adler's formula. So people somehow forgotten about this formula, or perhaps not. But the truth is that to my knowledge, there is no discussion of this formula in the papers of entanglement entropy. So their idea was very simple, was to think you have a fixed gravity background and you have a field, and then you integrate this field and to get an effective action for gravity, and then you expand this effective action around flat space in powers of the curvature, starting from some cohomological constant, the Einstein term, and some other polynomial terms in the curvature. And then you can, in this equality, you can derivate with respect to small fluctuations around the flat space, both terms, and you get that the way that Newton constant normalizes when you integrate all the field, the massive field here, is given by this formula here. That depends on the correlator of the stress tensor trace of the quantum field in flat space. This is already written in flat space. This is an integration in all, this is Euclidean formula, this integration in all d-dimensional space-time. And there is an extra term here, this O, that is expectation value of an operator that comes from derivating the stress tensor trace with respect to the curvature. So this will depend on curvature couplings in the Lagrangian, for example, for a scalar. So the idea is to think about this formula. This is for the Newton constant normalization, but some similar formula should hold for the area terms in entanglement entropy in flat space. But of course, by definition, if you have some universal term in the entanglement entropy in flat space, it cannot depend on curvature couplings. So it must be the case that this term is not present in the entanglement entropy formula. And also, this is an integral in all space-time, in particular for x tending to zero. This can have some contact terms, some terms that are like derivatives of the delta function there, and these terms can add up some number to this normalization. But in quantum field theory, these contact terms are not physical, so we want to eliminate them. We want to have a formula that depends only on correlation functions in the quantum field theory and nothing else. So the proposed formula will be something like this, without this term, and taking out possible contact terms at the origin there. Yeah?
Am I not sure that this Andrew formula was an anomaly matching type formula for essentially the wild risk table, which is what it comes to looks like? Now, in that way of thinking about it, it's not obvious to me that even though the curvature couplings don't matter when you evaluate them in cross space, because part of the calculation requires that you do it in cross space and then take them in cross space, but you don't get back like the finite residue.
Yeah. No, that's true. The other formula depends on all that.
Yeah.
And of course, the Newton constant normalization will depend on that. So I'm saying that what we expect for the area terms in flat space is not equal to the Newton constant. It looks like very much, and in many cases it will be equal, but it's not.
But is there an independent argument to say that the entanglement entropy shouldn't care about the whole thing?
Yeah, I think for me it's just definition, because, well, this is a controversial issue, but I can explain what I think about it. You think you are taking something that is universal, so something that belongs to the continuous theory, and it's something related to an entropy, so it cares only about the full model, right? The full model. So, for example, if you take a curvature coupling for the scalar, then the stress tensor will be changed. But in the theory in flat space, you have all the stress tensors with all curvature couplings there. So, and the full content of the theory has all this. You cannot just select one. It's a different story whether you have to take here one of these particular tensors. This is a different story. But the number that you aim to obtain is a universal thing that depends on only on correlations in flat space. So it cannot depend on any curvature coupling, because correlators for the scalar, say, in flat space, do not depend at all in these curvature couplings, right? Yeah.
So I'm still a little confused. So, I mean, from what you told us on the first slide, mu is not universal. Part of mu is universal,
yeah.
But part of it is not.
Yeah.
So I would have expected that the part that's not depends on some arbitrary choices, which include curvature coupling. So for example, if you cut off the theory by doing some replica trick, blah, blah, blah,
right,
then you'll find non-universal
no,
pieces
that's
which
correct.
Depend
yeah.
on the curvature coupling. If you
yeah.
cut it off in some other way,
yeah.
maybe you won't find. So.
Yeah, but this formula is also, in general, it can be divergent. So it also, this is not absolutely universal. In some cases, this
yeah.
is finite. This is completely finite. And then you expect that this does not depend on regularization. But in general, you have some divergent pieces that are not universal. So, but.
Are you saying that there's a. There's some part, so the thing on the top is finite, I guess, that the Adler Z?
This one?
Yeah.
No, it's not, it's the same as this. It's not, in general, it's not finite. There are some cases that which is finite.
But it's some
contact. No, because the integral itself.
Uh-huh. So why can't we just say that they both can be divergent and they both can depend on curvature couplings. And maybe they're equal, or maybe they're not, but I mean, that it's not, you know. I guess what I'm saying is that the divergent part, I don't see an argument that the divergent part can't be dependent on curvature couplings.
If you do calculation with the curvature coupling, for let's say for a scalar field, you get the wrong result. You get the wrong result. It's not you don't get this result. You get different result. Even some results that are not physical, for example, in three dimensions, this is finite number and it's negative, you can get some positive number there. So it's not physical in the sense it's not entangled entropy. It does not obey strong subadditivity, for example, constraints from that.
But this second definition is not conformally invariant, right?
This?
Yes.
Wait, there is masses.
Well, I mean, but if you were to define this in general, it wouldn't, I mean, because, I mean, the other definition is conformal trace anomaly kind of calculations.
I don't know the answer to that, but what I'm saying is that this explains all the physical results in flat space, let's say. Okay, well, this is a derivation in flat space of this same formula. It's taken essentially by Rosenhaus Smolkin paper in 2014. With some small modification, but it's essentially their work. They use this first law of entanglement entropy, where you know that the variation of the entropy is proportional to the expectation value of the modular Hamiltonian that is defined this way. It's a logarithm of the density matrix under trace with the variation of the of the density matrix. And here we are thinking that we have a half a space, so the entropy is proportional to some size of the wall, the area of the wall times this mu. So by derivating with respect to the size of the wall, you get essentially the same formula, the entropy times d minus 2. And then the idea is to produce variations in the density matrix, thinking in the path integral representation of the density matrix, doing some scaling, and the scaling just changes the size of the wall, or you can trade it of taking the size of the wall fixed and changing the coordinates in the path integral, and this will pull down from the action some stress tensor trace. And then you get this formula. The K here, the modular Hamiltonian for half a space is known and is proportional to the energy density integrated in half a space. So you get a formula that relates the entropy in this case with the stress tensor traces. And this formula can be simplified using the spectral representation of the correlation of stress tensor correlators, and you get from this some integral of the spectral density that happens to be exactly the same as this thing here. So if you plug here the spectral representation of the correlators, you get the same as you get from here. So of course, this does not tell us much about what to do with the contact terms or what we can choose as theta for in the cases that there is no unique stress tensor. Yeah.
If you go back, so the then your statement is that mu is zero in a conformal field theory because in your previous
yeah sure mu is zero in a conformal because mu I'm always writing mu in a in the sense of I'm looking for the universal part of it. Of course, the area term will have some divergent piece, that is there even for conformal field theories.
So you drop, so we just drop the contact terms, or because x is zero, the contact terms don't.
Yeah, the contact term, I'm not interested because the contact term will carry some non-universal information. So before starting to do the checks of this of this formula, let us review how this is related to C theorems. So suppose we go to two dimensions now. So in two dimensions, this has a 1 divided by d minus 2, so it's not really applicable. One can do things only on two dimensions and get the same result. But let us do the exercise to do a dimensional continuation of this formula. So we take out from here the dimension parameter, put in some mass to the appropriate dimensions, and put it the mass with different with the opposite power here. So if you expand around d equal 2, you get this formula that tells that there is a logarithmic term in the masses. Any scale of mass will do the job. And the coefficient is given by this integral of the stress tensor traces in two dimensions that happens to be finite. In fact, this quantity can be computed using some logic of Sohn rule for the C theorem that tells that the difference between central charges in the, between the fixed points is proportional to this integral. So what you get for the mu is just the difference between the ultraviolet and infrared C functions divided by 6. Times the logarithmic of masses times epsilon. So this is for only one boundary because we have only half a space. If you have an interval, it's just twice this quantity. And you can see that this is exactly what you get from, let's say, Cardi-Calabresi result because, because we know the entropy in the ultraviolet is proportional to some logarithmic of the size of the interval. And the infrared is again proportional to logarithmic of the size of the interval with the now the infrared C charge. But then the epsilons have to have in both cases the same coefficient. The log epsilon have to have the same coefficient because of these are terms, ultraviolet terms coming from the boundary is exactly the same. So you have to compensate for the logarithm of epsilon with some coefficient that is the difference between these two. And you have to compensate also for the logarithm of epsilon here with some mass. And then the term that is that appears is a logarithmic term of the masses with exactly this coefficient here. So the formula holds for any two-dimensional theory. So it's somehow Adler C formula down to the dimension 2 is a some logical formula. In d equal to 3, then we can think about circles, and then in the conformal point you have an expansion like this with some area term. Here some finite area term, and then some diversion piece and some constant term. And we know from Strong's relativity that the second derivative of the entropy of a circle is negative. And this can be used to investigate how the constant term renormalizes between the infrared and ultraviolet fixed points for very small and very large circles. And the same for the constant term here. There, so these are given by these integrals of the second derivative that is has a definite sign. So the constant term will always increase, while this area term it will always get negative value. And so this mu here should agree with this formula. And in fact, you can see that at this quantity is always positive, the sign perfectly matches with the other. and it also is interesting to see that this also tells that as if you go away from the conformal point, this quantity must be positive. It cannot be zero. So it means that the normalization of the area term has to be negative, different from zero. And it means that the second derivative has to be different from zero, and implies also that the constant term has to normalize. So it tells that you cannot have a running without changing the central charge. This quantity is also called the F of the F theorem. So the result is, in this sense, is very similar to the homological one. It's more indirect, but it's similar to this case. It can happen that this integral is divergent. In three dimensions, in general, it's not divergent, but it can happen that it's divergent if the way the theory departures from the ultraviolet is given by some perturbation of the conformal theory with an operator with dimensions between 3 and 5 half. You can just plug this power law that you obtain from this idea here, and you can see that there is divergence in this case. And this has been pointed out before by Hang, Myers, and Smolkin, and some other people, Lekowitz, Myers, and Smolkin, also by Liu Messei, that in general dimensions, you would expect that divergences appear in the in the area terms if you have deltas greater than d plus 2 over 2. And in the case where delta is d plus 2 over 2, you get logarithmic terms. So in this case, where the deltas are greater than this value, you expect to have, in general, that the area term has an expansion in epsilon that has some fractional powers different from the case of free fields that were only in integer powers. So I will discuss briefly what happens for a free scalar. For a free scalar, you have to plug here some thetas that comes from some stress tensor, but you have many stress tensors depending on this curvature coupling, let's say, or this term here. In particular, the conformal one is given by this number that depends on dimension. But when you do you go to the to the proof of the area term in flat space, you pull down from the action some trace of the stress tensor that comes from doing dilatations. And this will give you this quantity that is the trace of the canonical stress tensor with chi chi equal to zero. So and there is also the modular Hamiltonian, and the modular Hamiltonian has this T zero zero there. But in the case of free fields, you have the fact that the theory can be decomposed in modes parallel to the wall, let's say half a space. So is the calculation of the modular Hamiltonian is reduced to the two-dimensional case that cannot depend. So you can go back from two dimensions to higher dimensions, and you can see that it's not possible that in the modular Hamiltonian appears something that depends on dimension like this. So the canonical stress tensor is also selected for the modular Hamiltonian. So you arrive to the fact that you have to use this formula with the canonical trace. And the canonical trace is not like this, that one should expect that depends only on the mass, but it has also this piece. And this piece changes the game because it it will produce also logarithmic terms in four dimensions, for example. And you get, if you plug in this formula this canonical trace, you get exactly Wilczek and Herbert result. It's not the case if you put the conformal case that it only has this term. So So this is for some interacting examples that were studied in the literature. This paper by Medlitsky, Fuentes, and Satchev in 2009, even before the Herbert and Wilch paper, they discussed area term for a theory like this in three dimensions for the Ising model, where you have if you have this theory in three dimensions, you can do expansions in epsilon d minus four minus d, and you have the fixed point, the Gaussian fixed point, and they get this result that, of course, is the same as you get for the free case when you expand in dimension in terms of epsilon. The first term you get is something that depends on 1 over epsilon, so it has this dependence. This is like the first term in the expansion that will give you the full value, that the exact value is this one, just putting here d equal to 3. And they found, doing the replica trick and a careful analysis of the normalization and the singular surfaces, a very tough calculation and very detailed calculation, they found that the area term for the Wilson-Fischer fixed point, interactive fixed point, in epsilon expansion to lowest order in epsilon was given by this number here. What is quite surprising, because in epsilon expansion for small epsilon, you are doing a free expansion, let's say. So so in principle, one would think naively that this would match. But then you can understand this using the Adler-C formula, because for the free case, I have already said that you get the same result. But for the interacting case, you would put in the formula the conformally coupled tensor, that is the only reasonable one to put there. And then then you have that the theta has an expression more complicated, where you have to replace this chi by the conformal number. And there is also this new term here. If you do the calculation with this thing, you have to take into account that this Laplacian here will give you some contact term. If you replace it here by the equation of motion, it will give you a contact term. And you have to take away the contact term, otherwise you don't get the right result. So it also tells that contact term has to be eliminated. And if you eliminate the contact term and you put this number, you get this simple form of the stress tensor trace. And what you get from Adler-C formula is this value that now has the same gamma function here as the free case, but has also d minus 4 number here that kills the logarithmic term in four dimensions and gives something parametrically different in expansion around dimension 4. And exactly what you get is the Medlitsky, Fuentes, and Satchev result.
So a question, so if you perturb a little bit away from the Gaussian point, do you expect to get this one or that the other one?
If the ultraviolet fixed point is interacting, I will always expect to have this other one.
But do you get this one at finite coupling or at perturbatively in the coupling? Would you also expect to get this one?
No. This number is to order to the lowest order in epsilon expansion, right? Of course, it has to be the full number we don't know, but it's the same as this. This is very different from the right result. You have to put more powers of epsilon. This epsilon is not the usual epsilon of distance, right? It's the epsilon expansion dimensions. So this is worldwide Hahn, Myers and Smolkin, and the co is Myers and Smolkin. They studied this area terms holographically, and they found two puzzling results. The first one that was that putting a scalar mass term in four dimensions, they didn't get logarithmic term. That in the Wilczek case, you get this logarithmic term. And for a fermion mass, they get the logarithmic term. And the puzzling here was that the coefficient was exactly the same as in the free case. So even if the theory is interacting. But these things were also discussed by by Smolkin and other people. But the idea is that this is explained, for example, by this formula, by the same reason as in the previous slide, that in four dimensions, if you take the conformally coupled stress tensor trace, you don't get logarithmic term, right? And as the theory is interacting, you are forced to do that because you have to choose the unique stress tensor of the theory. And the case of the fermion mass term can be explained because the logarithmic term is an ultraviolet term, so it only depends on this expression. You will get that from the short distance expansion here, and once you have put that the perturbation around the ultraviolet is given by this term, this m here will appear there as the coefficient with the same power as in the free case, so you get the same formula. But of course, this number here in interacting theory is not the mass of the particles, so it's a formula that matches if you calibrate the mass term with the perturbation of the ultraviolet. Okay, let us come to the general holographic calculation. This is a work that we are doing with Eduardo Testea and Gonzalo Torroba. We've been some time looking for how to do this calculation, and fortunately, we convinced Gonzalo Torroba to join, and he really knew how to do it. The idea is that you now want to describe ADS-CFT, but without a conformal theory. So you put in the bulk a scalar field with some potential, and the field has a has a background shape that interpolates between some point in the ultraviolet to some other minima, to some minima in the infrared fixed point. And with some potential that is in principle quite arbitrary. There are some specific rules here, but in general it can be changed a lot. So you can describe a full set of theories in this holographic way, and you can analyze what is the the correlator of the stress tensor, and you also use Ryuta-Kayanagi formula to compute the entropy, and then the idea is to see if these two things match. First, this describes the background equations of motion. You take a metric in this way with some work factor here that depends on the R coordinate that describe the bulk space. R tending to infinity is the boundary of ADS, and R tending to minus infinity is the other boundary, the infrared boundary. So you get some equations that are similar to inflationary equations, let's say. And then, in order to compute the stress tensor correlators, you need to do perturbations around this background, perturbation for the the metric, and in principle also for the scalar field, but a convenient choice of gauge is the one in which the field is not perturbed at all. This we have followed the work by Kaplan and Wang in this sense, and I think the first that introduced this gauge was Maldacena. is a very convenient gauge. Once you do that, the price you pay is that you have to consider some terms that mix the R and the Minkowski coordinates. These are non-zero. So plugging all these perturbation ansatz in the equation of motion, you get finally this equation of motion for the perturbation of the work factor there. In principle, one has to solve this equation to get the correlators of the stress tensor traces. In principle, this is a second order equation for some A that depends on the background that is quite arbitrary. It's not possible to do it in general. But the simplification here is that what we need is this integral. And this integral in momentum space is just the Laplacian of the correlator of the stress tensor trace, but evaluated at p equal to 0. So we only need to know the small momentum correlator here up to order p squared. So here I'm changing coordinates, the R coordinate to the Z coordinate that is also used in holography. Z coordinate goes from 0 to infinity. One needs to compute the on-shell action for the perturbations. And the on-shell action, because it's a perturbation around the solution of the equation of motion, is going to be some boundary term. This is evaluated in the set ultraviolet. There is a very small set, so it's near the ultraviolet boundary of the ADS. And here we have some coefficients that depends on the background. And once you have this on-shell action, you have to take two derivatives with respect to the boundary values that you plug freely, and then you get the stress tensor trace correlator. And well, the idea is how to obtain here there is a derivative with respect to set of this quantity, so you need to solve the equation of motion. And the idea is that you can have asymptotic solutions for a small and large set of the perturbation that goes like Bessel functions, because there you can expand your equation of motion around this minima. And you have to take only the decreasing solution in the infinite, because you want this is a boundary condition at infinity, and you can have these two possibilities in the ultraviolet. In order to know the relation between these coefficients in the full solution, you need to interpolate with some solution in the middle. And for that, the thing is that even if you cannot solve this equation for all p, for p equal to 0, it's easy to solve because it's just a direct integral of some background numbers here. And you can also solve it iteratively in powers of p, just doing recursively solving this equation for p very small. So this is a solution that interpolates to order p squared. It depends on this function that are integrals and multiple integrals of the background things that depends on the background solution. So when the idea now is one have to match this asymptotic solution with this interpolating solution, and doing the matching, you can have this you can plug the result here and obtain what is the stress tensor trace. Well, doing all this together, what we arrive to this equation, that this quantity is equal to this thing here. So in order to analyze the result, let us think first dimension d equal to 2. So this term is absent. And d equal to 2, this disappears. So what you get is that exactly reproduces the Samoloshnikov-Sohn rule, because what you get is the difference between the ultraviolet and infrared of the inverse of A dot, and A dot is proportional to the length of the radius of the ADS space, so is given by the difference of a central charge of the conformal theories at the ultraviolet and infrared. And for D greater than 2, you get essentially that this quantity is given by this term here. And this term will give you some, in the infrared, this is exponentially decreasing, so it disappears. And in ultraviolet, this gives you some correction, some power correction here. That what it will do is to kill exactly the most divergent piece from this term here. But so essentially, the result is this term here with the most divergent piece subtracted here. But what is this term here? It's exactly the area term for the half space, because it's just the area of this surface that goes to in the direction perpendicular in the bulk direction to infinity. So so it tells that exactly the Adler C formula exactly holds in this sense, and it's interesting. That we expected at the beginning that we would have problems with divergences and these things will not match unless the things were like going to be the conversion. But it's interesting that you get matching for, if you do the same regularization in both things, in the sense of, for example, here we are computing this holographically and we are able to put a cutoff here. In this formula, you get exactly the same as the entropy with the same cutoff. Okay. So so this is just what happens to the normalization of the Newton constant for the free scalar, and how is this different to the entanglement entropy coefficient? So suppose you have a free scalar that is coupled to the curvature. So you get this long expression for the stress tensor trace. So you can use this expression and compute it with there is a Laplacian here. So this will give you a contact term in the calculation. And what you get from this is exactly the same as the entanglement entropy result for the free scalar. But there is an additional piece here that comes from this term, that is the derivative of theta with respect to r. So this new term, you have to evaluate the expectation value of this quantity. And it gives you some additional contribution that is proportional to the mu scalar, but depends on the coupling of the parameter. So the normalization of the Newton constant is not exactly mu s, but it contains this number here that, as I was talking before, it can change sign, for example, mu s in three dimensions, and you can get result that is unphysical because it doesn't have the right sign.
But that sign would also be problematic if you change the curvature coupling. The theory was not
how ground. Possible, yeah. So, and this result that you get from Adler C formula exactly matches with the, for example, the results that are quoted in the Birrer and Davis doing heat kernel calculations in cube space. So, it's exactly the same number. An interesting final point is that suppose that you here you eliminate the contact term just using the equation of motion here. So you replace the Laplacian of phi by something else. So this result, this part of the result will change. It's not. So it depends on how you put the contact term. But this changes. But at the same time, this other term also changes, because in replacing the equation of motion, you will change the way that the stress tensor trace depends on R. it will appear. This term will also give you some R term there. So it will change. So in the end, what happens if you eliminate the contact term in this way, you also change this other term. And the result is exactly the same. So really, it's a quite solid calculation in this sense. Yeah, sure, I finished.
So we should talk so that you can continue this question.
Okay, but this is all what I wanted to present. Thank you.
So a question. So is it clear that with the definition that you have in terms of the mutual information, if you had a boundary term in the boundary of file space, mu s won't change? Because, I mean, I think you can think that if you had a boundary term, like k pi squared, that you could think that this contact term, you can reproduce it from a boundary term in entanglement entropy. If you're doing naively, but I guess for the mutual information, it won't appear.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess so that it will not appear because it's there also for the two surfaces, right? But it's more difficult to know. But I guess it's these boundary terms, I think, are unphysical because of that. Because the only physical thing we have is mutual information that kills all these terms at the Puller boundary. A different situation if you have really gravity, because in that case, probably it has a meaning, the entropy itself. That's at least what the Beckett-Hawking formula tells us.
But suppose you didn't turn on gravity but wanted to compute the same thing in Curves X. Would you get a contribution from contact? Suppose
that's an interesting question. You are thinking in computing entanglement entropy in a curved space but fixed background.
Let's say S3 cross R.
Yeah, well, that's interesting, but I think hasn't been done carefully. In particular, one has to say what is the state. That's an important question because you don't have any more the vacuum. You have to choose.
The area term will depend on the state, because in flat space the area term doesn't depend on the state.
Yeah, the divergent piece doesn't depend on the state, but you are aiming for the universal part, right?
So does the universal part in flat space depend on the state?
Yeah, sure. If you don't take vacuum, you get something else, right?
The area term. Yeah, the area. I'm talking about the universal part of the area term.
That you can show is state independent.
I thought people say that with independent.
You normally expect the divergence is not dependent on the state, right?
No, but you can think you have a wall. You can think you have a wall and you have a thermal state that is just around the world, and you can get to a different number, right?
But you want back.
It will grow with the area.
Yeah.
So. No, but I think Matt's question is about the 1 over epsilon divergent piece. Your statement amounts to saying that if you have thermal wall, you will get an IR term, which will change the direction of the area. But the divergent piece will still, the UV divergent piece will still be inverse.
Yeah, the divergent piece, yes, but it's
that's
non-universal, right?
Or do you want it fully?
Well, I mean, the question is about the universal part of the area. I mean, the parts that are truly divergent are kind of uninteresting in some sense. So
for the quantum field theory,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.